more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
Photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners. It's June 2nd, 2019, and you're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday that can mean only one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Kristen Finch.
And I'm Adrian Gallo. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out all about the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our upcoming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests, and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight we are joined by Shauna Otto from the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics, where she works in the lab of Dr. Colin Johnson. Hi, Shauna.
Hi there. How you doing?
Thanks a lot for being with us on the show this evening. And you have, we'll talk more about your work with proteins in a minute in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics, but can you start off a little bit about just muscle cells and how muscles work?
Sure. So where the brain sends a signal out to your muscles through the nerves. The nerve is going to touch the muscle fiber or group of muscle fibers in one spot, and it's going to release a molecule called acetylcholine, which is going to be picked up by receptors on that muscle, and that's going to sort of trigger a Rube Goldberg-esque sort of cascade of signals that eventually results in the release of a bunch of calcium from what's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is similar to an endoplasmic reticulum, if you remember from intro bio. So a whole flood of calcium is released. This binds to a couple different proteins, and they then get out of the way and allow actin and myosin, a couple really abundant muscle cell proteins, to interact, and their interaction is what's going to create the force of the muscle contraction. And because calcium is used in this process, the cell is really super duper serious about maintaining calcium levels. The calcium level outside a muscle cell is typically 10,000 times higher than the concentration inside the cell. So your body works real, real hard after that nerve impulse and cascade to sort of sop up any remaining calcium and to get it sort of packed back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And if your body doesn't have the energy to do that, it can cause problems. So if you've heard of rigor mortis, that's because the calcium isn't being sort of sponged up or pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum because, you know, you've passed. so you get like intense muscle contraction for a while because the actin and myosin are just like
constantly tugging at
each
other.
Because of the calcium levels.
Okay, and what about damage to your muscle cells? Like, what does that look like, and what happens to the calcium if you have like a tear in your muscle cell?
So all cells are surrounded by a cell membrane, and that's what helps to keep the concentration difference across the membrane, along with a whole bunch of other channel proteins. So if there's a tear in that membrane, the calcium can just flood in. It's going to run down its concentration gradient. Like if you have a tear in the hull of a ship, the water is just going to really want to
rush in
and fill that vacuum. So this is obviously not great for the muscle cell, but it's something that happens regularly. You know, you're working out. There's a lot of mechanical insults that your poor little muscle cells endure. So the body has ways of patching those up as quickly as possible in a calcium-dependent manner, because it's really trying to stop that flood of calcium coming into the cell. So there's a whole like suite of proteins that pick up on that calcium signal and rush to the cell surface and sort of patch things up.
So calcium, and especially the concentration gradient, acts like kinetic energy. As long as you have mm-hmm. this, you know, strong difference in calcium concentration, then proteins are doing a lot of the work, mm-hmm. right? The calcium's kind of like that indicator flag that's like, all right, everybody go.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's proteins doing the contraction. There's mm-hmm. proteins doing all of the repair. Mm-hmm. And it's all driven by calcium as well. So how do these proteins work that they kind of flip a switch depending on how much calcium is there?
Well, that's sort of where my graduate work ties in.
That's where your dissertation is.
Yeah,
we're here.
So I'm working with a protein called dysferlin, which is involved in the membrane repair pathway. So sensing that calcium increase, recruiting a bunch of other proteins, grabbing up bits of cell membrane from little vesicles, patching them together, and taking it towards the surface of the plasma membrane. And so the protein I work with is pretty huge, 250 plus or minus kilodaltons. Just know that that's really large.
That's huge.
It's a honking protein. but I'm zoomed in on just one single piece of it, one domain out towards the tip, and it's 15 kilodaltons or so. So it's like a very tiny piece of it. So I'm looking to see how that particular domain responds to calcium. So what sort of conformational changes is it going through upon calcium binding? The calcium binding can cause it to change conformations, maybe have new functions, new interactions with lipids and other proteins and such.
So before we get deeper into the dysferlin world, mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about ferlins in general. It's a family of proteins, and there's kind of a bunch of different functions that they have in the body. And mm-hmm. if the protein doesn't work well, things don't go as planned.
Yeah. So in general, ferlins are membrane trafficking proteins. They're all on the large side, and they have what are called C2 domains, anywhere from 5 to 7 C2 domains. And these domains are usually they bind calcium, and usually they bind lipids, either anionic lipids like phosphatidylserine and phosphatidylinositols. And our lab is looking to see what exactly these proteins are doing, and they're different. They both have very sort of niche areas to work in. So a classical calcium sensor with C2 domains would be synaptotagmin, which works in the brain. But that one's a little bit smaller, only has 2 C2 domains, but because they're so similar structurally, we think they have a similar function. So 2 really well-characterized ferlins are dysferlin, which I work on, and otoferlin. And you talked about if something goes wrong in the protein. These 2 proteins, if you have certain mutations, you end up with a fairly drastic phenotype. So with dysferlin, if you have mutations in that protein, you can end up with a late-developing form of muscular dystrophy. So you muscle wasting, atrophy, fat deposition.
All related to the repair of the mm-hmm. muscle cells.
Yeah. Yes. And then with otoferlin, otoferlin helps to regulate vesicle release in the auditory pathway. So folks born with a mutation in this protein end up either congenitally deaf, or there's kind of an interesting mutation where they're only deaf when they're running a fever. It's like a temperature sensitive mutation.
Huh. Whoa,
which is pretty, really? It's pretty wild. You get a fever, you're deaf for a hot second. And then, and then it goes back down and you can hear again. So just a small mutation is having profound effect on the function of this proteins.
Let's describe one of the terms you've used so far, and that's conformation. And if my intro to bio memory is correct, conformation is kind of the structural arrangement and organization.
Yes.
And if a protein is kind of arranged in the correct way, then it can perform all the functions that it typically does. But if there is a mutation or the conformation is ever so slightly different, then that function is either impeded or it doesn't function that way anymore. Okay. And then the other one was conformation. Oh, and domains.
Domains.
So domains are like little regions.
Yeah. Technically, it would be an independently folding piece of a protein.
Okay.
Let's see. Any sort of like part that you could swap out, they're sort of modular. So if I wanted to build a protein that could add a phosphate to something and also goes to the plasma membrane in a calcium-dependent manner to do one of those functions, go to the membrane in a calcium-dependent manner, I'd slap a C2 domain on there. And for phosphorylation, I would slap a kinase domain on there. And then with their powers combined, they can, you know, do the function.
So kind of like Transformers. I guess Transformers have to be, well, I know some Transformers, like their arm can come off and do something cool.
More like where they all combine, like Voltron, sort of.
Oh, yeah.
Where they all
modular.
Come together. Yeah. And then together they're like
more powerful.
Yes. Okay.
They could be on their own. A C2 domain on its own might be a little boring, but pair it with six others and oh boy.
Now we have a big protein.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk a little bit more about dysferlin, if you're ready to go there, Adrian.
Yes.
All right, so dysferlin is the protein that you study, like you said, and you study just a small domain of this, and this is the one where mutations cause muscular dystrophy, the late onset form. And so how does one study a protein domain? And you're particularly interested in calcium, so how do you do that?
So the main technique I use is NMR, or nuclear magnetic resonance. It's very, very similar to the technology used in MRI. But they had to change the name MRI to MRI so the word nuclear wouldn't be in there because people get a little jumpy when they're going to get shoved into a machine with the word nuclear on it. But the nuclear refers to just the atomic nuclei that are present in whatever sample you're running. If you take an organic chemistry, you've definitely seen NMR. Proteins are a wee bit bigger than organic chemicals. So we have to use slightly more complex experiments to look at it, but the main concept is the same.
So I'm thinking back to organic chemistry, like learning what the frequency or what comes off of the NMR, it's got like peaks and stuff, and that's how you can distinguish between different functional groups. Is that my memory correct on that?
Yeah. So NMR, we stick our sample in a huge magnet, and the magnet is there to sort of force the nuclei in your sample into two different populations. Because the little nuclei are spinning, they have a magnetic moment, so they're little magnets. And the magnet can either be aligned with or against the magnetic field that it's feeling. So they can be up or down. And then there's a certain energy associated with the transition between up and down, if you want to call it that. And this energy is kind of in the radio region of the electromagnetic spectra. So you send radio pulses out to flip the nuclei between the two states, and then you can watch them sort of relax back to equilibrium. And you can figure out a lot about what the nuclei is doing, what sort of environment it's in, by tracking which radio frequencies are absorbed, so those little peaks.
Okay.
And then also how they behave when you poke them a little bit, and basically their relaxation pathway back to equilibrium. You can learn a lot of stuff about that.
Right. So I'm thinking you've got your dysferlin, and it's not had calcium yet, and then you feed it. So you do the NMR and you have kind of like your baseline of what it's looking like in this conformation without calcium. And then you like put in some calcium and you do NMR again. And then now you have a different NMR spectrum, I guess. And so you can compare them and then learn kind of what's going on in that domain.
Yeah. So I actually had to run my experiments starting at a high calcium concentration because my protein really hates being without calcium and will just like crash out over the course of a couple days. And NMR experiments, especially for structure, take
a long time.
A really long time.
Just to get a sense, how long do you have to run individual samples in your NMR tube?
It depends on the experiment. If I'm just doing a two-dimensional experiment, it takes about half an hour.
That's pretty fast. But for
so the 2D experiments, you take a one-dimensional NMR spectra like you would see in organic chemistry, and you just take a whole bunch of them and line them up, and then you flip it, and it sort of forms a topographical map with peaks on
it.
So, yeah, it just looks like a bunch of bullseyes, and that's the HSQC is sort of like the fingerprint of the protein. So each little dot or each little peak that appears on the screen corresponds to a single NH pair on the backbone, or there's some amino acids with extras. But so once I figure out which amino acid belongs to which spot, I can then, say, take away calcium. And then I can see a bunch of spots disappear because they're getting more flexible. I have also added ligands to the sample, phosphatidyl inositol or PIP2 to the sample. And you can see some of the spots move. And those spots are the ones that correspond to amino acids that actually make contact or kind of move to accommodate and bind the PIP2 moiety. So it's really cool and visual watching these little guys dance around.
This sounds like a 3D puzzle of which you don't actually know what it looks like when you start.
Yeah, especially doing assignments, figuring out what goes along with what. You do a whole bunch of experiments. The three-dimensional ones take days to do, and the whole suite probably take like 2 weeks from start to finish. It's a lot of just stick it in the machine and wait. So not a lot of on time for me, but once I get the data back, I think I likened it to a like three-dimensional Sudoku puzzle.
Oh, wow.
But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, like, oh, this kind of looks the same. Yeah, it was a lot of fun putting together. Frustrating, but I'm really enjoying the technique.
So what have you learned about dysferlin through this process?
So I was able to map the binding site for the PIP2. I'm in the process of using a couple other techniques to validate that and figure out what individual amino acids are doing. I'm also in the process of solving the bound structure. There's already a crystal structure out of the domain, but not in complex with this ligand that I'm interested in. I've found out which parts of the domain become more flexible and to what extent in the absence and the presence of calcium. Right now I'm working on mapping the binding site for another protein partner. So that's kind of the next thing that's coming up.
Very cool.
I'm excited.
So I just kind of I'm thinking about this again, and I have to remind myself that in proteins, structure equals function.
Oh, for sure.
So this three-dimensional Sudoku crazy map that you're doing, you're trying to figure out where all these pieces fit together and how they change and why, because again, the structure of it equates to some level of functionality that we can better understand and maybe in some ways in the future predict or manipulate so that it can function better.
We have to figure out how the protein works before we can figure out how to fix it.
Right.
Like, we know that there are deficiencies if there's a mutation, but if we don't know what it's actually doing in a really high-resolution way, there's really no hope of figuring out a way to fix it, either by gene therapies or a druggable target or anything like that. Like, you need to know the mechanism and what exactly is going on the molecular level.
Right. So thinking about proteins as a black box where we know there's calcium going in, some stuff happens on the outside. That's not good enough to do any kind of, like what you described, some gene therapy or any kind of stuff like that. So this is, Kristen, the title of the blog post is Microstructures and Macro...
Support.
Macro support. Yeah, this is really where I see it kind of coming together. Mm. What do you have an example of another protein or a similar example where we have kind of gone through this process? We do know how a specific protein does function. And what have we been able to do with that kind of knowledge?
Hmm. Oh, man. There's so many.
Yeah, which one's your favorite? Which one do you want to pick from?
Oh, gosh. I'm really interested in signal transduction pathways just like sensory transductions. That's kind of what led me to Colin's lab, was the otoferlin side of things. But I think something that we've gotten really, really into detail with is rhodopsin in the eye. Like, we know like exactly what's going on. Not, I don't know about exactly what's going on there, but we have a very clear idea of what's going on in the active site.
So what is that one?
You're saying we can see it very clearly?
Yes.
Yeah, what is a rhodopsin?
Oh, so that is... a membrane protein that's in the visual pathway, thus the seeing it clearly pun. Thank you for that. and it has a ligand that isomerizes when it comes into contact with light. So it's that isomerization of the ligand that translates into a conformational change, which again starts this Rube Goldberg pathway.
So instead of being calcium sensitive, it's photosensitive.
Yeah.
Oh, wicked.
Yeah, and like taste receptors, same thing. Instead of being calcium sensitive, it's pH sensitive. So the tart taste is just hydrogen ion concentration, or salt, just salt gated channels, umami flavored stuff. It's just a glutamate receptor. It's all, yeah.
And so that triggers, the example then is proteins that we know a lot more about. And so we know that more about their structure, thus more about their function and what turns them on and excites them and leads to the sensory perception that you're describing. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, like, ballpark, like dysferlin. How far away are we from maybe knowing more about, or knowing everything, or much as we know about rhodopsin?
Oh, God, it's a giant protein.
Yeah, so
I haven't even talked about the fur domains. Oh,
like 100 years?
Oh, gosh.
We should also mention for the listeners that the larger the protein is, the harder NMR becomes, because you have to isolate certain domains without it affecting the conformation of the other domains.
The size matters for NMR for other reasons aside from that. If it gets too big, the peaks aren't very well resolved and they just kind of fade away into the background. You have to do some really expensive stuff like grow it up in deuterated water, which can get real pricey.
Yeah.
Very, very expensive. And at a certain point, you just can't see it anymore. So there are like really, really cool people doing large complexes with NMR. But I'm a wee baby just learning, so I'm going to stick with this 15 kilodalton.
All right.
Little buddy.
So, you know, you work on dysferlin, which is a very important protein. And that's actually, you work on a small portion of the protein, a small domain, and how calcium influences its function. But I don't imagine you were playing around with Legos as a kid, telling yourself, like, oh, I'm going to figure out how dysferlin works.
Oh, yeah.
So
was that procession?
Pipe dreams.
So what was your first experience with science, and what did you start off school doing?
So first experience with science, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. So Bill Nye was a big thing. He's up in Seattle. So that was super cool as a 90s kid, having that kind of wacky example.
I didn't realize he was in Seattle.
Yeah. Mostly just mucking around in my backyard, poking at things, you know, looking at stuff under a microscope that my parents didn't know how to use. So I like kind of figured it out. I didn't know what the immersion oil was for. But through middle school and high school, I was pretty okay at both math and science, and with the STEM push, like that's how you're going to make money. That's sort of why I got into it. I started off as a marine biology major. My high school, they had a marine biology intensive program. So it was just sort of a natural, like, oh yeah, I'm going to totally work with dolphins. Did not happen. Nobody gets to work with dolphins. It's very difficult. You're going to be working with echinoderms. And whereas I really like diving and sailing, I couldn't really see myself out on a boat for months on end or working in an aquarium or something. So I left school for a little bit due to some financial and personal reasons. Came back as a chemical engineer because I was real sick of earning close to minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And I thought I had the math chops for it, but I didn't really enjoy that either the first couple intro classes. So I switched to biochemistry, I guess my second term of my first year back. I remember waiting in line to grab lunch in the campus, not really a diner, little campus pub, with my general chemistry professor. And he was like, oh, well, what's your major? You know, just, you know, talking to your student. And I told him engineering, and he made a face.
For the listeners, it was a, ew, gross face.
I'm like, oh, why are you wasting your time with that face? And it's like... It's like, oh, why don't you do a spin in my lab and give research a try? And so I did, and I enjoyed it. There was a laser table involved. Very cool.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Fun machines.
Yes. Give me lasers. It's all sorts of good stuff.
And at this point, you're an undergrad, and that was the time that you decided to switch into biochem.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and so... what particularly about biochem and I guess working with it were you really interested in? Like what was going on in his lab?
So his lab was looking at how human serum albumin bound a couple different drugs. So human serum albumin, it's a really abundant protein in the blood. It binds all sorts of stuff, free fatty acids, a couple different drugs. I think we were looking at warfarin. This was like 10 years ago at this point, so.
Yeah.
Sorry. But what about biochemistry in particular? I found chemistry to be a little dry. That is, of course, very naive because my only experience with it was general chemistry. And I was like, okay, I'm good at this, but who wants to do PV equals NRT for the rest of their life? maybe physical chemists. More power to you. The straight up marine biology was a little bit too squishy for me. I needed things more quantitative. I just didn't think my skill set would work well with like a field biologist. So the biochemistry was a really nice compromise. And just the problems that they're working on are very have a real world applicability, which is something that I enjoyed and sort of took from the engineering.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KBVR Corvallis 88.7 FM, and this is Inspiration Dissemination, where we're talking to graduate student, PhD student actually, Shauna Otto from the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics, and she was just telling us a little bit about her work with Disferlin protein, one of the domains of Disferlin, and all the awesome machines and stuff that she gets to work with. And now we find out that in undergrad, she was already working on proteins and a little bit about what goes on within our own cells as an undergrad.
But this wasn't the only professor that you worked with. You also worked with a physical chemistry professor as well.
So the first one was also a physical chemist.
Oh, okay.
I worked for three physical chemists turned biochemists. So the second professor, how do we want to transition into this? So the first professor, we ended up not getting along very well. I had some issues come up shortly after I joined his lab, and while he was supportive research-wise, I don't think he had the tools to be as supportive with what I was going through. So in the early 20s is generally when mental health issues can start to spring up if they've kind of laid dormant before, and that's what happened with me. And through, can I call this a Rube Goldberg-esque cascade of unfortunate events? I ended up not having a place to live for a good, like, 6-7 months during my tenure in that lab. And the professor knew about it. He actually found out about it from MySpace. This is how long ago this was. He was my friend on MySpace and saw that I had posted, like, hey, anybody have a place to crash? And like pulled me into the office and talked to me about it. And the solution there was to sleep in lab. He gave me a camping mat, which was very sweet. But probably not what I needed at the time.
Well-intentioned, but maybe not the support that you're needing at the time of that this is going on.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if it was like a couple-week thing, it would have been fine. But it was sort of long-term. And it got pretty bad. That laser table I mentioned before, there was blackout curtains around it because, you know, you can't just have lasers pew-pewing all over the lab. You have what's called a blackout curtain, goes floor to ceiling to keep any like stray beams from going off. And when the cleaning staff would come in the evenings, it's usually like once a week, it was probably Thursdays, can't remember, but I would close the curtains and I would hide under the table as like they came through and cleaned. And yeah, that was a real, real low spot there.
So I can imagine that for an undergrad, you're like, you know, you're trying to keep up with classes, trying to figure out what you're going to do next for your career and maintain like good standing at the university and stuff like that. But you're also going through this major life experience and this hardship. And I'm wondering, like, that must take some kind of toll. Like, how did you get through it?
Oh, God. Well, if you look at my transcripts, I didn't really. It was a really, really rough time GPA-wise. It was really hard to study when you're really hungry or you don't really have a spot to sit down like with your books.
There's no place
like to feel safe.
Yeah.
Sort of. So... GPA took a toll. Credit ratings took a toll.
How long would you say that went on?
The first time was definitely over a summer and into the next school year for a bit.
Okay.
I ended up getting a job doing supplemental instruction the next year, which is, I don't know if they have it here, but it's student-led courses to sort of help with traditionally difficult undergrad classes. So I was doing supplemental instruction for general chemistry. And so I was able to get employment there, which was really great. And that continued throughout my tenure at Long Beach. So that kind of helped me dig myself out of it that time. So I'd say maybe 6 months or so.
Okay. And so you were able to find this like extra employment that kind of helped with that.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily through like university resources or like necessarily through the help of your mentor at the time.
Yeah.
So then transitioning into the next part, like what happens after that for you?
So like I said, there was some friction between us. I didn't really like where the research was going. And he would make jokes like, oh, you're all going to be a lab anyways, so why don't you go ahead and do this for me? And I just, this just really didn't feel great. And while I really enjoyed undergraduate research, like I couldn't still stay in that situation. And because I had had a place to live now and didn't need the lab to sleep in, I went ahead and left. And so the student job wasn't really enough to cover all my expenses because it was only 20 hours a week at whatever slightly above minimum wage was then. So while it helped, it couldn't really make all my ends meet. So I took up a couple other random side jobs. I was a florist for a while. That was kind of fun. I worked for two different floral folks. One was just like a cute little stand on the side, and the other one was like a wedding florist. And that was, ooh, a whole nother world.
And it was at this time that you were essentially for the first time seek mental health care treatment.
Right? I sort of limped through the rest of my undergraduate degree. I was uninsured, like many folks are before Obamacare, and you could stay on your parents' insurance until 26 or so. I ended up working for the second physical chemist. I took his physical chemistry course, and he kind of knew my story just through hearsay, and then approached me about doing work in his lab and suggested I do a master's to sort of rehab my undergrad degree. And with the master's came a TA ship, and with the TA ship came insurance. So I was finally able to...
And that was the first time
you
had insurance in forever, basically.
Yep, since I was like 19. Yeah, so there was a good like 5-6 year gap where I didn't have any insurance.
So I'm going to play an ignorant PI. And okay, mm-hmm. Now that you have healthcare, now you can, get your yearly physical and you get an eye exam, now you're totally good, right?
So with mental health, a lot of times it's a long process to figure out what exactly is going on, in part because we don't know a lot about the molecular mechanisms of
how all of that works.
So how you'll respond to certain treatments is really, really individualized, and they don't have a good way of knowing, we just need to put you on this drug and you'll be fine. So it was definitely a process, and like I still am seeing somebody regularly to make sure that nothing pops up again. But it was pretty bumpy during my master's, and I didn't actually finish that. I ended up matriculating here to Oregon State for the PhD program before I finished, and took a downturn and wasn't able to wrap up the thesis, unfortunately. But there wasn't a lot of understanding about the process of seeking help at my old department. Just not a lot of knowledge there with the ins and outs of it.
Yeah, maybe not a lot of communication about it already, and then not training for folks of how to kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah.
Well, definitely that, right? Because, you described two unique circumstances of two PIs, but it's not an isolated, those are the only people that don't know how to be in a leadership role as a PI.
Mm-hmm.
And also know what help to offer, and knowing that a camping mat probably isn't sufficient to offer your undergrad. But that's kind of a problem that plagues a lot of PIs, that they don't have any formal training generally for how to run a lab and how to make sure your graduate students are okay. Like that's...
Yeah. Me, maybe a couple years from now, after, say, a postdoc, will be qualified to be a PI. even though I've had no formal training in pedagogy, well, I have had a little bit of training in pedagogy, or any of these sort of soft skills. I'm doing air quotes right now because they're not soft. They're well, I guess they're, I suppose they're soft, but they're really essential for maintaining peace and harmony in your lab and just making sure that nobody falls through the cracks in your department. So I'm pretty passionate about bringing up these issues with people in my department and just trying to make the whole process a little more just.
It does seem like in academia, folks are starting to talk more about mental health in that there have been several articles and meta-analyses looking specifically at graduate students and kind of the emotional and physical toll, even financial toll, that it can take on folks, and that now that we're talking more about it on Twitter and in social media where these articles are really getting some traction, that hopefully in the future it will be improving and that maybe some trainings will start to crop up where PIs and folks that are in the shoes now that we will all be transitioning to, maybe for us going forward in academia, will be kind of a better community to learn those things.
Yeah, no, there's been a definite shift in the conversation that I've seen over the past 10 years or so. I think I was looking at somebody's syllabus and they had a basic needs statement at the end saying like, oh, if you need help with finding food or shelter or anything, like you can come and talk to me about it and I will direct you to resources. It's in the syllabus. Like that was completely unheard of back when I was having issues. And it's much less stigmatized. Like all my cohort and other grad students, or we joke about going to CAPS for therapy, but like we do that to make sure that people know it's okay,
right?
To go see somebody and talk stuff out. And like my stuff definitely predated grad school, but it's a rough time for anybody, and making sure the departments have resources, have knowledge of the resources on campus to give out to students is really, really important to me and really, really important to maintaining the health of just your department and your, yeah.
So something that you said during our previous conversation was that during your master's, you took this class on, I think, membrane transport or membrane trafficking?
Membrane biochemistry.
Membrane biochemistry. And that really got you interested in kind of what you're doing now, which, like we said at the beginning, is looking at this protein that patches up holes or, like, has some role in that hand-wavy, not sure yet because Sean is figuring it out as we speak, has some role in that repair mechanism. And so that class you mentioned had gotten you interested, actually, in working with your current PI, Dr. Colin Johnson, here at Oregon State. And so that's like what brought you here. And so how has it been better, I guess, at Oregon State, or has it been different, or has your life experience previously, did it kind of like facilitate in like, this is something that I need, this is a conversation I need to have and make sure that this is going to work for me to continue and start this new PhD here?
Coming to Oregon State was definitely helpful. Just in starting a new sort of page, starting, you know, tabula rasa. I didn't have the conversation with my advisor about these things because I was fairly closed off about it. I remember running off to CAPS my first year and like not telling anybody, like sneaking down to the building, like, oh, I hope nobody sees me. So I knew I needed support right off the bat coming here, and luckily we have great insurance. Thanks, union.
Yes. So
I was able to get an off-campus therapist really early, and they're actually psychiatrists on campus. You can go see at the Student Health Center. So I got situated there pretty quickly. The conversation with my advisor came definitely later. It was actually, I guess, the first, like, frank conversation and not just me like dropping hints that I have issues came earlier this year where I had a kind of a pretty bad downturn, and my psychiatrist here suggested that I go to DAS and talk to somebody about accommodations.
And DAS is Disability Accessibility Services?
I think so. I'm awful with acronyms.
I'm going to double check just to make sure.
I do know that it's ds.oregonstate.edu if anyone is interested in following up with that.
Disability Access Services.
Access,
and
yes.
We're also going to post links to CAPS Counseling and Psychological Services through our Twitter page, and you can also find it on our blog post as well.
Yes. Yeah, so your CAPS therapist mm-hmm. helped you find DAS services here on Oregon State. So what is that?
Or
for you, I know for everyone it's different. But.
Yeah, so for everybody it's different. As a graduate student, I had coursework, but I'm all wrapped up with it now. So things like traditional accommodations you would think of would be like extended test time, mm-hmm. A quiet space to do exams in. But I didn't think any of that really applied to me. I can't have extended time to write my thesis. I guess I could, but it's not a sit down in a room and write your thesis situation. That would be horrible. Oh God, I'm sweating. So I didn't know what my options were. So when I sat down with the woman that they hooked me up with and started talking about it, we came up with the idea of sort of a mental health concierge relationship. I'm not really sure how else to explain it.
Right.
So she would act as a go-between between me and my PI and other people in my department that needed to be sort of in the loop just to know that, yes, Shauna is okay. She's just having a rough time right now. And so having her in the room when I, like, had the conversation with my PI and the graduate advisor from my department was really helpful. Just having a nice neutral third party who already kind of knew my story, and she could say things on my behalf while I'm kind of a sobbing mess.
Right. So it's one thing that it's something that she does that you don't have to do because you can now focus on feeling better or like taking care of yourself so that you don't have to worry about emailing or worry about like making sure that such and such is covered or that the NMR is turned off or something like
that. Oh gosh, that is not my job. It's beyond my pay grade.
Okay. Well, whatever it is.
Please don't turn the NMR off.
Really but bad. you have someone that's helping you as a buffer or as a messenger or just someone that is advocating for you and needing to take some time or whatever it is.
Yeah, usually when my downturns happen, like 25% of it is just kind of in the moment feeling awful, like I'm wearing a lead vest. And then the other 75% is me feeling awful about feeling awful. Something that someone with a cold or something wouldn't really worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But just like the guilt, like, oh my gosh, I had to take time off for myself. It's unacceptable. Having somebody there to sort of ping my advisor and anybody else that needs to be in the know that, hey, Shauna's just taking a couple days, knowing that they know my situation, it makes it much easier to transition mm-hmm. back into being productive and feeling good instead of self-flagellating for like 75% of the time. Like, how dare you?
Do you think that is kind of related also to the expectation for graduate students in academia? Like maybe there is this like real graduate student guilt in that like it's maybe not an expectation that is strict with your advisor, but mm-hmm. just because of the pressure of it all and the need that you're on your own path and you're kind of like setting your direction and setting your own deadlines, that taking time for yourself feels like you feel guilty about it.
Yeah, like we have no set hours. I'm supposed to be working 0.49 FTE, but oh no. Setting your own hours and having a very loose schedule can be helpful for somebody in my situation because I can just make up for lost time. But yeah, the guilt of not being in lab and having to take time for myself is, got to be a bit much.
So you have an advocate to kind of like offset that.
Yeah, yeah.
on that note, I think something common to most graduate students is because we're often doing lab work or field work, we are physically isolated from others where, you know, you're in the lab at odd hours because reactions take weird times to do. And by the time you're physically isolated, you're kind of mentally tired, you're sleepy. And then you let that go on for, you know, a month because you're trying to pump out all your lab work before that conference at the end of the at the end of the quarter. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, my gosh, I'm a mess. So I think it's rather easy to kind of get in that hole and not realize you're in the hole.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know where I was going with that. That was just a personal, I found myself in the hole and was like, oh no.
Yeah. It, like, oh no, how do I get myself out now? Oh no.
Yeah. And I didn't even realize I was digging myself in this hole.
I'm 30 feet down.
Yeah.
No rope.
Okay. So we'll do a transition onto, so the way it sounds at least is Oregon State seems to have been a little bit of an easier way because we have this kind of foundation of services available and your PI was also really open to kind of working with you instead of just, well, not being very helpful like other people. So I wonder if you can kind of look back and think how Oregon State has been impactful in your success as a researcher.
Yeah, just giving me enough as a graduate student in terms of pay. The insurance is great. The on-campus services are great. I don't know if it's a consequence of just the time frame that I was here versus at my previous institution. You know, it was like a 5 to 10 year gap, and just the conversation has changed a little bit more. I think if I had continued at my previous institution, well, I didn't finish my master's, but if I guess I was going to do a PhD there, it probably wouldn't have been successful just because of all the history and, you know, once you ask for help and don't really get it, you're kind of like shy to ask for it the next time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what sort of made me put up barriers, set up my own barriers to asking for help here.
So actually,
I'm not really sure where I'm going with this, but
so on that note, you know, we typically end our show with we ask you for advice, and this is the first of two parts of advice I'm going to ask. But the first part is, how do you break the stigma of talking about mental health to your research group or to your PI on kind of this micro level instead of the social level, like going through the Twitter sphere and whatnot, like. Do we accept that it's the first conversation is going to be really darn awkward?
Yeah, it's real, real awkward. Sorry, there's really no getting around it. I guess the more people that have this conversation, the less of a stigma it's going to be. It's, I don't know. It's like any sort of chronic medical issue. Or it should, at least should be, about as stigmatized as, you know,
the flu.
Rheumatoid arthritis or the flu or some, or you know, recurrent flu or something. Because it's definitely cyclic. It's probably just going to be real awkward. Maybe do it over email. It's slightly less painful. You don't have to be in the same room as them. How I broached it early on is I just said, gave blanket, like, oh, I have a recurrent medical issue. I will occasionally be out from time to time. I'll try and keep you in the loop. That's how I framed it initially. But let me tell you, after sort of breaking the ice just by like sobbing in a room in front of him, it was like pulling off a Band-Aid. It was real bad. But now everything's fine because everything's out in the open. I don't feel like I have to hide it, which caused more stress than I think it needed to. Just rip off that Band-Aid if you've got a recurrent sort of medical issue or mental health issue. If your PI is not cool with it, that's their problem.
And it's that not the union on can you. Help with.
Yes. Hopefully everybody is tuned in enough to the conversation to know that it shouldn't be a problem. They need to work around it. You know, there are laws against not working around it.
Right.
But it makes it a lot easier just to not have to hide things. So just rip out that Band-Aid, guys.
And so what would your advice then be for our listeners?
It's okay to ask for help. And it's really hard to not take it personally when the help isn't given. But it's okay to ask for help again and look elsewhere and to just really take care of yourself. Yeah, you deserve more than you think you do, or you deserve exactly how much you think you deserve. I don't know.
Yeah.
So we end the show on a song. So you chose Keep On Living. And why did you choose that song?
It's definitely one that I tune into to sort of boost my mood if I've had a rough day or week, month, I don't know, longer. You just kind of have to keep on living, keep on trucking, even though like stupid stuff's making you cry and you just can't get out of your own head. You just got to keep on living and it'll eventually turn up.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Shauna, for sharing your story with us and for coming on Inspiration Dissemination to tell us about Disferlin as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah. All right. So this is Inspiration Dissemination. We're on Sundays at 7 p.m. from Oregon State University campus. We're going to end our show with Keep On Living by Le Tigre. Thanks again, Shauna.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, please tell your friends about it and give a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts so other podcast peeps can find our show.
The theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline, and the intro jingle was created by Olin Hannum. Special thanks to the supporting staff for KBVR that allowed this show and podcast to be possible.
The show was started by Gian Kamvar and Joey Holber in 2012. Its hosts include Matt McConnell, Steve Friedman, Mackenzie Smith, Kristen Finch, Adrian Gallo, Lillian Paget-Cobb, Lori Lutz, Heather Forsyth, Maggie Exton, Scott Classic, Marcus Weinman, Daniel Watkins, and Harrison Steierwalt.
To learn about other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, please visit our well-curated website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration.
And finally, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at KBVRID and Facebook at Inspiration Dissemination.
Thank you for listening and stay curious, my friends.